Octavia and Paz seem like nice girls, but what if they are plotting to get BB fired? Because he fears that's exactly how this is going to end. If it doesn't turn up by tomorrow, Chad says, hitting these words hard so BB gets the message, can we just replace it? I've already looked online, Ms. English says. That particular belt, with the rose gold buckle, has been discontinued. She looks from Chad to BB and back. I don't have to remind you that this was a VIP guest, nor do I have to remind you that if and when a guest accidentally leaves something behind, it does not belong to you. It goes directly to the lost and found. Chad bobs his head while BB scowls. He can't believe she isn't more concerned. If she loses her job, she's sunk. I was crystal clear that this was never to happen again, Ms. English says. Maybe the ghost disappeared it, BB says. Did you think of that? If the belt doesn't turn up by tomorrow, there will be consequences, Ms. English says. Do you hear me, Barbara? As Chad and BB head up to the second floor with their cleaning cart, BB says, why do you think she said only my name? Bring it back tomorrow, BB, Chad says. We can hide it down in the laundry. You think I took it too? BB says. Really, Longshot? She looks so wounded that Chad again wonders if maybe he's wrong. Maybe BB didn't take it. Maybe it was Octavia and Nevis. Or possibly, maybe Shelley put it in a side pouch of her luggage, and she'll find it next week when she flies to Dubai or Cartagena, and she'll call the hotel to apologize. Or maybe the person pilfering the luxury goods is Ms. English. Ha, he thinks. No, it's BB. When Chad gets home from work, he finds the driveway of his house lined with cars and, parked in Chad's usual spot, a van from the Nantucket Catering Company. He tries to recall the date and realizes it's Monday, August 8th. Are his parents having their annual 8-8 cocktail party despite what happened? The answer is obviously yes, but the fact that neither Paul nor Whitney mentioned it to Chad, did they? Means his presence might not be expected, which is a relief. It also makes what Chad has to do far easier. He enters the house and hears conversation, laughter, strains of Christopher Cross, his mother is having a moment with Yacht Rock, coming from the deck out back. Chad takes a second to see who's in attendance. Bryce's parents from Greenwich, Jasper's parents from Fisher Island, Paul Winslow's business partner Holden Miller from the Brandywine Group, and Leith and her friend Divinity, who are wearing matching Love Shack fancy dresses. Chad again racks his brain, but he has no recollection of hearing about this party. He's offended that his parents are having it. He understands they want to proceed as though nothing has happened, but a party? Really? Chad hurries up the stairs. He might tell his parents he skipped the party in protest or that he didn't feel like he deserved to celebrate the 8th of August, considering what he'd done. He heads into his parents' room, the master suite, which is a universe unto itself. There's the actual bedroom, then there's his mother's sitting room, his father's upstairs study, the palatial marble bathroom complete with jacuzzi tub for two, and his and her walk-in closets. Chad goes to his mother's closet. He hasn't set foot in here since he was 8 years old when they moved in, and tries to guess where Whitney keeps her belts. Her hanging clothes take up three walls of the room, and the fourth wall is floor-to-ceiling cubbies for shoes. There are 64 pairs of shoes here on Nantucket, where a woman could make it through the summer with sneakers, flip-flops, and one pair of sandals. He tries not to think about Patty. In the center of the walk-in is a free-form structure of drawers and shelves where Whitney keeps folded things, light sweaters, pashminas, t-shirts, her yoga clothes. There's also a tall, slender dresser by the door. Chad avoids the two top drawers, assuming they hold his mother's underwear, and opens the third drawer. It's socks and stockings. The fourth drawer holds clutch purses. There are half a dozen. Chad gets on his knees and opens the fifth drawer, which holds, bingo, belts. They're coiled up like sleeping snakes, and Chad pulls them out one by one. Hermes, Tiffany, Louis Vuitton, and... yes, he just can't believe his luck. He really can't believe it. A black suede Gucci belt with a rose gold double G buckle. He doesn't have to think twice. He takes it. On his way out, he gazes down at the party from his parents' picture window. The sun is setting, making all of the vivacious, well-dressed guests look like they've been dipped in rose gold. He thinks about how easy it would be for him to change into Madras shorts and a pink Oxford and slip through the crowd, shaking hands, making eye contact, saying, "Yes, sir, good to see you, sir. Definitely looking forward to working with my father in September. I can't wait to dive into the world of venture capital." Chad knows he could quit his job tomorrow and be finished with Bibi's kleptomania and her complaining. He would never have to scrub another toilet, fold another towel, or see another hair wrapped around a bar of soap. He could golf all day, then drink a Mount Gay and tonic and eat mini crab cakes with people who talk only about Wimbledon and their stock portfolios. But he can't pretend May 22nd never happened. He has to do penance. That's what his job at the hotel is all about. It's an atonement. Maybe Patty will never learn about Chad's job, or if he does, maybe he won't care. But Chad is going to keep at it anyway. He likes living a life of purpose. He wraps his mother's belt around his fingers like brass knuckles and heads down the hall to hide in his room. The next morning, Chad leaves for work an hour early. No one notices. His parents and Leith are all still asleep. They were rocking out to Bob Seger and Madonna until almost midnight. And when his mother inevitably knocked on his bedroom door and asked him to come down and make an appearance, please, Chaddy, people are asking about you, he said he'd be down in a minute, knowing his mother would forget. And she did. Chad arrives at the hotel at 7 and uses the service entrance, the belt inside an old L.L. Bean backpack of Leith's that he found in the mudroom. He waits until Joseph, who runs the laundry, goes on a cigarette break. Then he buries the belt in one of the big rolling baskets of dirty linens. Not all superheroes wear capes, he thinks. He's always wanted to say that about himself, but of course, he never had a reason. Until now. At the start of his shift, 55 minutes later, Ms. English announces that the Gucci belt has been located in the laundry. It has, Bibi says. You sound surprised, Barbara, Ms. English says. Not surprised at all, Bibi says. She's a liar and a thief, Chad thinks. But he admires her audacity, and he hopes she got a good price for maybe Shelley's belt. I knew it would turn up. Lisbeth finally connects with Heidi Bick, who suggests they go to the Blue Bar for dinner. Lisbeth says, I will eat literally anywhere else. I have to get out of this building. But not the deck, Heidi says. Not the deck either, I'm sorry. Lisbeth could return to the deck now that Christina is gone. In a weak moment, Lisbeth texted JJ to ask how he was doing, and he replied, I miss you. Lisbeth had stared at that text long and hard, but she didn't feel angry, she didn't feel sad, and she didn't miss him back. She misses Mario. Lisbeth and Heidi meet at Bar Yoshi on Old South Wharf. They're seated at a high top by the windows that overlook the harbor. The restaurant has a spare, chic vibe with lots of light wood, a floating glass-fronted cabinet that holds the liquor bottles, and excellent woven basket light fixtures. Lisbeth loves this place. She plans to completely overdo it on the sushi. She feels good. She is out, finally, with a girlfriend. Lisbeth orders sake, Heidi a tequila cocktail, which is unusual for her. She's a devoted rosé drinker. Everything okay? Lisbeth asks. Heidi's eyes widen. You mean to tell me you haven't heard the rumors? I have no one to hear rumors from, Lisbeth admits. I'm always at work. I never see anyone from my old life. Well, I heard you were dating Mario Subiaco, Heidi says. Someone saw the two of you at the Pearl. Their drinks arrive, and Lisbeth raises her sake glass to Heidi's highball. I'm glad we did this. They touch glasses and drink. Heidi inhales nearly half her cocktail in one gulp. The thing with Mario didn't work out, Lisbeth says. It was a good rebound, though, right? Heidi says. He's so hot and such a legend. Lisbeth doesn't want to talk about how hot or legendary Mario is. So tell me about the rumors, she says. I'm ready. But as it turns out, Lisbeth is not ready. You remember how I told you Michael was up here all spring by himself working on a project? He and this guy from his office, Rafe, want to splinter off and start their own company. Lisbeth definitely remembers that Michael was here alone. Oh, does she? Well, when I showed up in June, I found an eyeshadow in my makeup drawer that wasn't mine. Oh, Lisbeth says. She already doesn't like where this story is going. Then I found a pair of Rene Cauvilla stilettos in my closet, size 6. What? Lisbeth thinks. There's only one woman brave enough to wear Rene Cauvilla stilettos here on Nantucket, Lyric Layton, Heidi's best friend. In her life before husband, children, and yoga, Lyric was a shoe model in New York. Lyric? She says. And then I found a positive pregnancy test tucked into the pages of the book on my nightstand. You did not, Lisbeth says. As I'm sure you've heard, Lyric is newly pregnant with her 4th. Lisbeth has not heard. The hotel really is a fortress. So you think there was something going on between Michael and Lyric? This is smoking hot, scandalous news. No wonder Heidi is drinking tequila. Along with curiosity, Lisbeth feels relief that the mistress wasn't Alessandra. That's what I thought, yes. That's how someone wanted to make it look. So it wasn't Lyric? Lyric swears not. She said if she and Michael were having an affair, there would be no way she would leave those things behind for me to find. Right, Lisbeth thinks. No way. Heidi throws back another healthy swallow of her drink. We have a key to the Layton's house labeled on a hook in our mudroom. Michael thinks someone from his company found out that he and Rafe were planning on leaving and set out to sabotage him. Lisbeth blinks. Michael thinks the guy he called to fix our Wi-Fi was actually a spy who saw the key, because, you know, the router is in our mudroom, and this guy burgled the Layton house while they were out and then planted those things in our house. Michael thinks the cable guy did it? Internet guy. Wow, Lisbeth says. She brings her sake to her lips. Her guard is back up. There's no chance a man would know to plant an eyeshadow, shoes, and a pregnancy test. Well, I guess you're relieved it has nothing to do with Lyric. Yes, definitely, Heidi says. Though it did real damage to our friendship. She's angry that I suspected her. Heidi leans in. But you have to admit, it's a hard story to swallow, that the internet guy set Michael up. Lisbeth nods. Very hard to swallow, she thinks, like a handful of steel screws hard to swallow. Heidi sighs. But Michael is in the world of petroleum, and you know how ruthless that is. Is it the kind of ruthless that would stick someone else's pregnancy test inside a book on Heidi's nightstand? Lisbeth wonders. Or plant a different brand of eyeshadow, a different type of shoe? No, Lisbeth thinks. It wasn't the internet guy, and it wasn't Lyric. It could have been some woman that Michael was sleeping with, a woman he met on the ferry and decided to let stay a while because it was a raw, chilly spring on Nantucket, and he was always up for a little action with a beautiful woman, and because Michael essentially gambled for a living, and because this other woman was wily and had no morals. Alessandra saw the key to the Layton's house, and she'd probably gathered through eavesdropping or a casual conversation that the Laytons next door were close friends, and she burgled the Layton's house so that when she vacated the premises, Heidi would think Michael was sleeping with Lyric. I'm having the ramen, Heidi says. What about you? I haven't even looked. I want sushi. But Lisbeth can't think about sushi. She isn't sure what to do. Should she tell Heidi what Alessandra said about meeting a friend on the High Line back in April and staying with him on Hulbert Avenue? Should she describe following Alessandra by bike and being caught by Alessandra right in front of Heidi's house? Should she then mention how Alessandra is a casual liar who showed up with sketchy references All of them European, like she's the talented Ms. Ripley? Should she tell Heidi how Alessandra is so startlingly beautiful that she's managed to overwhelm the hotel's male guests? It's a proper quandary, one meant for an advice column. If I suspect a friend's husband was cheating on her with someone I know, do I tell her? Or do I let her believe that it wasn't a mistress, but rather a revenge plotted by her husband's nefarious work colleagues? The affair, Lisbeth reasons, is over. Heidi and Michael are settling back into their summertime routine of beach and tennis and driving the kids to camp and going out to dinner. Who is Lisbeth to disrupt their lives on a hunch? She has no actual proof it was Alessandra. But one thing is for sure. Lisbeth is going to start watching Alessandra more closely. The spicy tuna roll looks good, Lisbeth says. And let's get some sashimi. August 8th, 2022. From Xavier Darling, xd@darlingent.com.uk. To employees of the Hotel Nantucket. Good morning, all. This week on Travel Tattler, I noted a lovely review of our hotel that expressly mentioned bellman Ezekiel English. This guest praised Ezekiel's intimate knowledge of the island, including the recommendation of Stubby's to satisfy our guest's late-night case of the munchies. Outstanding job, Ezekiel. XD. Edie and Zeke are, once again, eating ice cream together in the break room when Raoul pops his head in and says, "Congrats, Zeke, you won the bonus this week." "I did?" Zeke says. And Edie thinks, "He did?" They check their phones, and sure enough, there's the letter from Xavier. Zeke laughs. "Those guests were plastered. They'd just gotten back from the chicken box and the dude was starving. I guess he assumed there would be chicken at the chicken box." Edie offers a lame smile that Zeke doesn't seem to notice. "But since we all know there is not one piece of chicken at the chicken box, I sent them to Stubby's, and he wrote about it. Ha!" "Ha," Edie thinks. Her crush on Zeke has only grown more excruciating with each passing day, but that doesn't stop her from feeling bitter that he won the money for recommending Stubby's, which is essentially Nantucket's version of a McDonald's drive-thru. "Why were you even working night bell?" she asks. "Where was Adam?" "It was the night he and Raoul went to the White Heron to see that play," Zeke says. "I covered Adam's shift." "He deserves the money," Edie thinks. "He worked a double so Adam and Raoul could have a date night." She feels resentful that she can't even be properly resentful. Zeke tosses his nearly full bowl of ice cream into the trash. "I'm going to run to Indian Summer and see about a new longboard," he says. He gives Edie's shoulders a squeeze. "Your boy is hyped." Edie would normally be glowing from the half hug and the use of the term "your boy," but once Zeke leaves, Edie feels bereft. Then, something on her phone catches her attention. August 8th, 2022. Abigail Rashish, Cornell School of Hotel Administration, alumni Facebook page. "Warning to my fellow hoteliers, and especially to anyone who shares my obsession with Shelley Carpenter." I assume this means everyone. "There's a woman at large who is imitating Shelley Carpenter. She shows up solo and presents IDs in various obvious aliases. When she checked into the Woodstock Inn, where I've recently been promoted to FDM, her ID said Diana Spencer. She asked for a room upgrade, presented a written list of requests, and did that thing of trying to subtly take photos and type notes into her phone. I'm not ashamed to admit that I was completely fooled. I bent over backward to get Diana Spencer a room upgrade, and I even gifted her a bathrobe after she asked where we sourced them. I was aghast when Diana Spencer called the next day to say that she'd left a Prada raffia tote behind. We couldn't find the tote. Our housekeeping staff hadn't seen it, but nevertheless, we offered to replace it, which cost us over $1,000. Of course we replaced it. We were dealing with Shelley Carpenter, or so we thought. Then, a couple days later, I heard from classmate Chasey Peck, class of 21, who's the concierge at Round Pond in Kennebunkport, Maine. Chasey had a woman come in with an ID that said Miranda Priestley and who went through the same motions with room upgrade, list of requests, and sourcing questions in order to get free merch. A day after Miranda Priestley checked out, she called Round Pond claiming to have left behind a gold Tiffany T bangle. And when the housekeeping staff couldn't find it, they too replaced it free of charge. This woman is not Shelley Carpenter. She's a con artist. I'm posting this so that no other hotel falls for her ploy. Shelley Carpenter has the dubious distinction of becoming such a phenom that she now has an imitator. Could this day get any worse? Edie wonders. She, too, tosses her ice cream and goes to knock on Lisbeth's office door. Lisbeth reads the Facebook post and groans, "Are you kidding me?" When Chad hears the news, he can't wait to tell Bibi. Maybe Shelley, the woman who stayed in the owner's suite, was an imposter and there was no missing Gucci belt. It was a scam. "So now you believe I didn't take it?" Bibi says. "I'm sorry," Chad says. "I just couldn't figure out. And I know you like nice things." "I'm not a thief, long shot," Bibi says. "I have a daughter. I need to set an example." "I thought maybe you did it because you needed the money." "I do need the money," Bibi says. She narrows her eyes at him. "If it was a scam, then where did the belt that Ms. English found in the laundry come from?" Chad is tempted to say, "Must have belonged to someone else," but instead he blurts out the truth. "That belt was my mom's. I took it from her and planted it in the laundry because I didn't want you to get in trouble." Chad isn't sure what kind of response he's expecting. Maybe a thank you, maybe aren't you sweet. But Bibi just barks out a hard one-syllable laugh. "Who's the thief now?" she says. Chapter 20. Good kind of trouble. Edie sends out 10 resumes to other hotels, including the Little Nell in Aspen. Edie's mother, Love, worked there in the 90s, and the Breakers in Palm Beach. Edie has decided to work somewhere else only for the winter season because she wants to come back to the Hotel Nantucket next summer. Lisbeth has told her they're already full for certain weeks in June and July. Zeke said he's coming back next year as well. He's going to spend the winter surfing in Costa Rica, and Adam and Raul are returning. The only person who hasn't committed to coming back is Alessandra. Maybe she'll turn tail and run back to Italy, Edie thinks. Although she has to admit, Alessandra has mellowed a bit recently. Adam told Zeke that Alessandra has been staying in every night, eating dinner in her room with the door closed. "Something happened with her, I think," Adam said, "but she won't tell us what." Edie is on the desk one gloriously hot and sunny afternoon by herself. Alessandra is at lunch, and everyone else is at the beach or the pool or biking to Sconset for ice cream or hiding from the sun at the Whaling Museum. Edie has a moment to check her phone just to see if all 10 of her cover letters and resumes went through on her email. And that's when she sees the Venmo request from Graydon for $1,000. Edie huffs out a short, indignant laugh. The nerve of him. No, really, the nerve. Edie isn't sure why. Maybe because she now has a plan for her future. Maybe because working the desk has made her more confident. Maybe because she has Lisbeth as a role model. But she decides in that moment that she has had it. She will be bullied no longer. She deletes the Venmo request and sends Graydon a text. "We're finished. Leave me alone." 3 dots surface on the text stream immediately, and Edie gets a hot, prickly feeling as she imagines Graydon typing. His response? "Pay me, or I'll send the videos to all of your prospective employers." Edie gasps softly and looks around the lobby. It's cool and serene. Jack Johnson is singing about turning the whole thing upside down. Edie hears splashing from the family pool and a moped going by out on Easton Street. She starts to shake. How does Graydon know about her resumes going out? Well, he must have access to her emails and maybe her texts as well, maybe her entire cloud. Did she ever give him the password? No, but it wouldn't be difficult to guess. Nantucket Girl 127, her birthday. She's tempted to call him, but that will end one of two ways, with her screaming or with her crying and begging. He knows she has student loan payments. He knows Edie and Love's financial future is uncertain. Love actually asked Lisbeth if she could use one more person on the desk. Love did it under the pretense of offering help, but she needs the money. And Lisbeth snapped her up. So now Edie's mother is going to be working one night shift a week to give Richie a break. Graydon also knows that Edie's shame about what she did, what she agreed to, is deep and painful, and that she'll do anything to conceal it. Through the blur of tears, Edie takes inventory of the lobby. No one needs her. The phones are quiet. Zeke is stationed by the door in case of emergency. Edie runs to the break room, and as soon as the door closes behind her, tears fall. "Edie," a voice says, "are you okay?" Alessandra is sitting at the counter with some kind of craft project in front of her. Both this and the unexpected concern in Alessandra's voice stop Edie from going into a full-blown meltdown. "Fine," Edie says, wiping quick fingertips under her eyes. She approaches Alessandra as she would a venomous snake and peers at the project before her. It's an 18-inch frame, the inside of which is spread with some kind of adhesive. Alessandra is pressing in broken pieces of pottery and colored glass. She has only half the square completed, but from where Edie is standing, it looks kind of like... Alessandra says, "I'm making a mosaic." "I didn't know you were crafty," Edie says, and this makes Alessandra laugh. "I'm not, particularly," Alessandra says. "I just wanted to try my hand at this. It's harder than it looks. You have to lay down the pieces and hope that when you step back, it makes the hole you're looking for."
"It's a woman's face," Edie says. "It looks like you. Is it you?"
Alessandra shrugs. "I've always thought of mosaic as this big metaphor for my life," she says. "All these jagged, incongruous pieces." She holds up a small shard of milky jade green glass. "These are like the things that happen to you. But if it's laid out a certain way and if you take a step back from it, it makes sense." Edie thinks about her own life, growing up the beloved child of two wonderful parents on an island where she felt safe and nurtured and championed, where she was such a success academically that she was accepted to an Ivy League college. Cornell was its own dreamscape. Edie loved the hotel school, her classes, her professors, the guest lecturers from New York City and Zurich and Singapore, and the natural beauty surrounding the campus. There was nowhere prettier than Cascadilla Gorge in the autumn. But then, in January of her junior year, Edie returned from her facilities management lecture to find Love and the dean of students sitting together on the bench in front of her dorm. When they saw Edie approaching, they both stood up, and Edie nearly turned and ran. She knew her mother hated to drive on the mainland, especially in winter. Edie's father was the one who always brought her back and forth. He had dropped her off just a few weeks earlier. Love never would have made the 7-hour trip from Hyannis to Ithaca under anything but urgent circumstances. There was also an unfamiliar expression on Love's face, a mixture of grief and dread. Edie dropped her backpack on the path and raced into her mother's arms, knowing before Love even said the words that her father was dead. Edie took 10 days off from school, and when she returned, she had acquired the questionable mystique and celebrity of someone who had undergone a tragic loss. Students whom Edie knew only tangentially, including Graydon Spires, the most popular and successful student in the hotel school, offered condolences. Everyone talked about Graydon's poise, his charm, his silver tongue, his social savvy. Edie's best friend, Charisse, once remarked, "It's almost freakish the way he always says the right thing." And not only did he say the right thing, Edie learned, as she got to know him, he also always struck the right emotional note. He wasn't a conversational skater. He didn't speak simply to fill silence. He didn't do small talk. He listened and responded in a genuine and intelligent way.
When he turned his light on Edie, asking her out for a midnight snack of burgers and coffee at Jack's, "I'm guessing you're not sleeping much these days," she fell in love. They grew close very quickly, too quickly, Cherie said. She was offended by Edie's sudden abandonment. Within days of the date at Jack's, Edie was always with Graydon. When junior year ended, they both accepted summer jobs at Castle Hill in Newport, Rhode Island. They worked at the hotel's front desk and found they were dynamic together. The atmosphere in the lobby all summer was electrifying. The air crackled with the barely sublimated sexual and romantic energy between Edie and Graydon. They tried to outdo each other in customer service in a good-natured way, and the guests and management ate it up. They scheduled Wednesdays off together, when they did all the Newporty things, went to Annie's for lunch, hung out on Thames Street, did the cliff walk, sailed on the hotel's sunfish, biked around Fort Adams. Edie couldn't believe how Graydon had appeared just when she needed him most. She imagined the life they would have after they graduated. They would work together in hotels in Alaska, Australia, the Azores. They would climb their way up the corporate ladder at a major hotel chain, or they would start their own hotel chain. They would get married and have babies. When they returned to Ithaca for their senior year, Edie was tapped to be the student director of the Statler Hotel, a very, very big deal. When Edie told Graydon, she expected him to pick her up and swing her around like it was the end of the war in a movie. She thought he'd take a selfie with her and post it on his Instagram with the caption, #girlboss. But right away, she could see he was jealous and resentful. It was right after this that Graydon started asking for things in bed, things Edie wasn't entirely comfortable with, and eventually was mortified by. But she consented because she felt she had to apologize for her success. Graydon recorded everything they did. He told her that made it way hotter. And Edie, who wanted only to please him, did what he wanted and recited her lines. As Edie stands before Alessandra and her half-finished mosaic, she gets a text from Graydon. It's a picture of a box of Pocky, the long chocolate-covered cookie sticks from Japan, and Edie feels a wave of nausea roll over her. She rushes into the one-person bathroom and can't decide whether to cry or throw up. She does a weird hybrid of both, desperately hoping that Alessandra will be gone when she emerges. "Please," Edie thinks, "pack up your mosaic and leave." The mosaic of Edie's life would be cute around the edges, bits of rose-colored glass and hand-painted bone china, but in the middle would be a chunk of tarry asphalt, black and oozing. When Edie steps out, Alessandra hands her a bowl of vanilla soft serve ice cream topped with M&Ms, which is Edie's go-to snack. Edie didn't realize Alessandra even knew her go-to. "Sit," Alessandra says. "Tell me what's wrong. I want to help." For 2 months, Edie and Alessandra have worked side by side, and Alessandra has only been a hostile nation, the Axis to Edie's allies. Alessandra's unyielding coldness has caused Edie hours of anxiety and, she's not afraid to say it, a little heartache. It's not fair for Alessandra to be nice now when Edie has finally grown immune to her being not nice. But Edie wants to tell someone. And who else does she have? She no longer speaks to Cherise, thanks to Graydon. She can't tell her mother. She couldn't possibly confide in Lisbeth, and she can't tell Zeke. Edie picks up the spoon just so she'll have something to do with her hands. "My ex-boyfriend is blackmailing me with videos I let him take of us when we were still together," Edie says. "He sent me a Venmo request for $1,000 and told me if I don't pay him, he'll send the videos to my prospective employers. Before that, he threatened to send them to my mother." Alessandra nods ever so slightly. Ah. She doesn't seem shocked or appalled. But then, she hasn't seen the videos. She hasn't heard the things Edie said into the camera. She hasn't watched the acts. "No one can see those things," Edie thinks. "No one." She has to pay him the $1,000, even though that's 40 hours of work. "I have to pay him." Alessandra scoffs. "You do not have to pay him. You realize that posting revenge porn is a crime, right? A class 4 felony? You can call the police. Edie thinks about calling the Nantucket police and speaking to Chief Kapanash. There is no way. And that's why women don't turn in their abusers, she thinks. It's humiliating. And the possibility of victim shaming is very real. I can't call the police, Edie whispers. He's out in Arizona. Phoenix? Marana, Edie says. Alessandra's eyebrows shoot up. He works at Dove Mountain? I know the property. I'm sure the GM there would find his behavior very problematic. I'm not going to call his GM. He's threatening to post videos without your consent, is that right? Edie nods. And he's blackmailing you. How much money have you sent him so far? Edie bows her head. Edie? $1,500, she says. What? Alessandra jumps to her feet. We're getting that money back. Just give me his phone number and let me take care of it. I can't, Edie says. Edie, Alessandra says, I'm going to scare the hell out of him. I'm going to pretend to be someone else. Now, I know I've given you no reason to trust me, but surely you have faith that I can be a convincing bitch on the phone and I can get this guy. What's his name?
Graydon Spires.
I can get Graydon Spires to do exactly what I say. You believe that, right? Edie considers this. Can Alessandra be a total bitch? Yes. Can she get men to do whatever she wants? Also, yes. She gives Alessandra the number, then squeezes her eyes shut. She overhears fragments of the conversation.
Mr. Spires, this is Alessandra Powell with the Pima County Sheriff's Department. Report of threats against... Class 4 felony before you even get to the blackmail. Understand you work at Dove. We can either come round you up, Venmo the amount of $1,500 back to the victim. Internet fraud, identity theft, prosecute to full...
There's a pause. Edie can hear Graydon's voice on the other end of the line. Does he have just the right words for Alessandra now? Is he hitting the correct emotional note, contrite but charming? He was only kidding. He would never dream of posting. Alessandra says, I don't want to hear your bullshit, Mr. Spires. Venmo Ms. Robbins what you owe her immediately and leave her alone. Otherwise, we will file an electronic restraining order. If you ever threaten to post those videos again, we'll arrest you immediately. Am I understood? The crystal under Alessandra's right eye seems to wink at Edie. Am I understood? She pauses. Well, I hope so. I won't trumpet my own accolades, Mr. Spires, but I've created quite a reputation wiping up the floor with little men like you. She ends the call and tells Edie, if he doesn't Venmo you what he owes you immediately, I'm going to fly out to Arizona and put his balls in a vice grip until he turns it over. But you are getting that money back. Edie looks at Alessandra.
Thank you.
Alessandra smiles. Not the cold plastic smile Edie has grown used to, but a warm, genuine one that illuminates her face and makes her look like a completely different person. You're welcome, Edie, she says. Edie's phone dings. A Venmo payment has just come in from Graydon Spires for $1,500. Richie and Kimber are having the kind of summer romance that people write songs about. Songs like Summertime by Cole Porter, A Summer Song by Chad and Jeremy, Summer by Calvin Harris, and Grace isn't sure how she feels about it. On the one hand, she can tell it won't end well. They aren't being honest with each other. But on the other hand, they both seem so happy. And how can that be a bad thing? Now that they've, Grace will say it, even though they haven't, fallen in love, Kimber's insomnia has disappeared, and she lets Richie work the night desk undisturbed. She goes to bed after tucking in the children and doesn't stir until Richie joins her at 2 a.m. Then there is some spirited adult time. Kimber and Richie sleep intertwined, always in pajamas because of the children, until 7 o'clock, which is when Louis heads out to the lobby to play chess, and Wanda asks the hotel guests if they've heard the mystery of the haunted hotel. Wanda is Grace's own little PR person. Kimber goes down with them and then brings two cups of coffee, light and sweet for her, splash of milk for Richie, back to the suite. The children eat the complimentary breakfast in the lobby. They're both partial to the croissants filled with almond marzipan that Beatrice makes, and Richie and Kimber skip breakfast for more alone time. Then they shower and embark on their day. Kimber seems to have abandoned writing her memoirs for the time being. She hasn't been on her computer in nearly 2 weeks. Richie and Kimber deliver Louis to his chess lesson with Rustem and Wanda to the Athenaeum so that she can read quietly for an hour and check out the next Nancy Drew mystery. She's up to number 26, The Clue of the Leaning Chimney. Then they return to the hotel, put Doug on a leash, and disappear out the side door to go for a walk. The afternoons are adventures, ones Kimber selects from Lisbeth's blue book, and that Grace gets to live vicariously through the photos on Kimber's phone. Grace sees pictures of the big enough for two sandwiches they get from Something Natural, turkey, Swiss, and tomato with sprouts and mustard on the famous herb bread, and watches the videos Kimber took of their trip up to Great Point. The long arm of golden sand in the afternoon sun is so appealing that Grace yearns to be able to leave the hotel, if only for the afternoon. She hasn't been to Great Point since before her brother died. George used to take her up in his fishing boat. There are pictures of Richie surf casting with a rod Grace knows he borrowed from Raoul, and then some photos of the children frolicking in the water with seals. Doesn't Kimber know that seals mean sharks? Doesn't Richie know? What kind of outdoorsman is he anyway? Another day, they ride the hotel bikes out to Matticat and have lunch at Millie's. There's a picture of a seared scallop taco with purple cabbage slaw. And over the weekend, they head out to Sconset to do the bluff walk. Grace remembers that bluff before a single one of those homes was built. She used to pay a nickel to take the train to Sconset. There's a sweet photo of Richie and Wanda holding hands while Richie walks Doug, and a funny one of Louis appearing to hold the Sankaty Head Lighthouse in the palm of his hand. The late afternoons are always bittersweet because Richie has to be at work by 6. He showers and changes in the suite, kisses Kimber long and deep, then heads down the hall to the front desk. He still makes phone calls in the middle of the night in Lisbeth's office with the door closed, Grace notes. She finds this disappointing and blows cold air down the neck of Richie's dress shirt, but that doesn't stop him. Then there's a happy development for Richie and Kimber. Edie's mother, Love Robbins, is willing to work one night shift per week, giving Richie the night off. Because of the children, there's only one place Richie and Kimber can go for dinner alone, and fortunately, it's the only place either of them wants to go. The Blue Bar. "I'll just charge it to my room," Kimber says, and Grace notes the relief that washes over Richie's face. Grace peeks in on the two lovebirds on their date. They order a cocktail called Good Kind of Trouble and start feasting on yummy bites and spreads and dips and crunchy snacks. After their second Good Kind of Trouble, Kimber orders the decadent caviar sandwiches. Eventually, Beatrice, the whipped cream concierge, comes out with shot glasses of chocolate mint-flavored whipped cream, and Kimber and Richie feed each other with the tiny spoons, then start kissing. And Grace can sense the bartender, a real pistol named Petey, thinking, "Get a room." At exactly 9 o'clock, Petey flips a switch under the bar, and one of the panels in the coffered ceiling slides open, and the copper disco ball drops. White Wedding starts playing, and Richie takes Kimber's hand and leads her to the small dance floor in front of the penny-sheathed wall. They dance to Burning Down the House and Hit Me with Your Best Shot and You May Be Right as brilliant copper spots of light spin around them. Kimber throws her head back and windshield wipers her arms in the air, while Richie does moves he calls the lawnmower and the shopping cart.
Kimber is laughing. Richie is hamming it up. Then, Faithfully by Journey comes on and they press their sweaty bodies together and shuffle in a tight circle. Some dancing lessons should be in their future, Grace thinks. And when the song ends, Richie leads Kimber back to the bar where she signs the bill, leaving Petey a huge tip. Kimber throws back what's left of her good kind of trouble and, in the spirit of the greatest decade of the 20th century, cries out, "Take me to bed or lose me forever." It's 5:30 in the afternoon a few days later. Richie is in the bathroom shaving before he has to go to work. Kimber is sitting on the bed, still in her bikini, sandy from the beach, her skin golden from the sun, her hair newly dyed flamingo pink, which is actually quite flattering. Kimber watches Richie swipe clean strokes through the shaving cream with his chin lifted just so, and she blurts it out, "I love you." Richie's head jerks a bit. He's lucky he doesn't cut himself. And his eyes meet hers in the mirror. Uh-oh, Grace thinks. Is it too much too soon? Kimber is always pushing the envelope. But then Richie sets down his razor and, with half a face of shaving cream, kisses Kimber. "I'm so in love with you," he says. "Maybe more in love than I've ever been in my life." Way to double down, Richie, Grace thinks. That night, very late, when Richie comes to bed, Kimber says, "You know what I think we should do tomorrow? Go see your place. The children have been asking where you live when you're not here." She scratches her fingernails lightly down Richie's chest. "And I have to admit, I'm curious too." Richie seizes up.
"My place is really small," he says. "A dump, actually. I wouldn't want the kids to see it because I don't want them to feel sorry for me."
Kimber waves a hand. "They won't care, they're kids. We'll just swing by and poke our heads in before we go to 40th Pole tomorrow. You said Cliff Road? That's on our way."
"Not a good idea," Richie says. "My landlady, Mrs. Felix, said no visitors."
"We won't even set foot inside, and we'll stay 2 minutes," Kimber says. "The children just want to see—"
"Kimber, no."
Richie's voice is sharp. Kimber waits a beat, then sits up in bed. "I just think it's weird that we're in love and I've never seen where you live. It's suspicious. And after what I've been through with Craig, I just have to ask, is there something going on between you and Mrs. Felix? Or was there?"
"No," Richie says.
"Then I guess I don't understand why—"
"Because I don't have a place to live," Richie says. "There is no Mrs. Felix. I made her up. I lied to you because I didn't want you to think I was pathetic, and I lied to Lisbeth so I could get this job, which I desperately need."
"What?" Kimber says. "Where were you living then, before you moved in here?"
"The break room," Richie says. "And my car."
"Your car?" Kimber says. The look on her face is one of naked horror, and Grace can't blame her. Who lives in his car? A hobo? This is it, Grace thinks. This is the end of the cute romance.
"I need to save money," Richie says. "I'm in so much debt, Kimber. The divorce carpet-bombed me financially, and I thought if you knew I didn't have a place to live, you would think I was using you so I could live in the suite."
Kimber's eyes shut for a moment, then fly open. "I asked you to stay overnight in the suite and you said no. I practically had to beg you."
"I would never want you to think I had ulterior motives," Richie says. "That's why I was so hesitant to start this relationship. It wasn't you. You're beautiful and fun and spontaneous and a terrific mother. Bringing your kids here for the summer instead of shipping them off to camp or keeping them holed up in the city. It was that I'm homeless. My ex-wife took the house in Connecticut and I gave up my apartment when I moved here. You can do so much better than me, Kimber."
This is probably not untrue, Grace thinks. "I don't want to do better," Kimber says. "I don't need a rich man. I had one of those and he ditched me for the nanny. I need a man who loves me and who won't leave me."
"I won't leave you," Richie says. "Someone would have to physically drag me away from you at gunpoint."
This is probably not untrue either, Grace thinks, nor unlikely.
August 15th, 2022. From Xavier Darling, xd@darlingent.com.uk. To employees of the Hotel Nantucket. Good morning, team. I'm pleased to be spreading the wealth again this week and awarding the $1,000 bonus to Adam Wasserman Ramirez, a guest of the hotel sang, wink wink, Adam's praises for his showmanship at the piano during the wine and cheese hour. He indulged the guest's wishes with a rendition of Let It Go that the guest said gave me goosebumps. Well done, Adam. Here's hoping you don't leave us for the Great White Way. XD.
Adam deserves the bonus, Lisbeth thinks. He plays the piano for the guests after his shift is over, purely for the joy of it. But the thing is, every member of her staff deserves the bonus, every week. She hopes Xavier will see that once he comes to visit. Her phone dings with a text, and she has the same Pavlovian response to the sound that she's had for weeks. Mario? But the text isn't from Mario. It's from JJ.
I'm taking tomorrow night off. Can we talk?
Lisbeth inhales, exhales, takes a sip of her coffee. Fine, she says. I'll meet you at the spot at 8. Lisbeth and JJ's spot is the proprietor's on India Street. On Saturday nights in the off-season, the bartender, Tenacious Lee, would save them the two stools at the end of the bar. Lisbeth hasn't set foot in proprietor's in months, and although she's ambivalent about meeting JJ, it's a meeting, not a date, she tells herself, she feels only joy when she strolls down the brick sidewalk to the white clapboard house built in 1800 and opens the lipstick red door. Hello, old friend, she thinks. The restaurant's interior is one of her very favorites. There are refurbished wide plank floors, exposed brick, Edison pendant lights, and a long white oak bar with a pressed tin front. On the walls hang displays of mismatched china and a collection of antique door escutcheons. On the tables are mason jars filled with Nantucket wildflowers and flower sack napkins with sage green stripes. Lisbeth almost left the proprietors out of the blue book because she never wants the bar to become a place that's three deep with tourists ordering Cape Codders. In the end, she tucked it into the fine dining section, calling it eclectic, a place for people who want a thoughtful dining experience and the most creative cocktails on the island. Lisbeth has arrived before JJ on purpose. She waves at Lee, embraces her across the bar, then orders her usual, a cocktail called Celery Man, which is made with mezcal joven. Lisbeth has, quite intentionally, not touched tequila in months either, and celery syrup with a white peppercorn rim. It's a savory cocktail, which she prefers to sweet. Sorry, heartbreaker. Lisbeth relishes the first ice-cold sip. She has missed this place. Are you waiting for someone? Lee asks. Lisbeth shrugs. Maybe. Lee cocks an eyebrow. And the very next second, she breaks into a smile. Look what the cat dragged in. It's just like old times. Can I get you the usual, chef? Please, JJ says. Lisbeth stands and greets him with a hug as though he's an old friend from high school. He takes the opportunity to squeeze Lisbeth tight, and she inhales his scent. Boy fresh from the shower, ivory soap, wintergreen aftershave, a lingering hint of the cigarette he smoked on his way here. When she pulls away, he says, You look gorgeous, Libby. I don't think I've seen that dress before.
You haven't.
Lisbeth is wearing a red, crinkled cotton sundress, short to show off her legs, and her nude wedges. They take their stools, the same ones they've sat on 100 times before. When JJ's drink arrives, they touch glasses. Lisbeth has unwittingly slipped right back into her former life. This is a meeting, she reminds herself, not a date. She knows Lee is not only tenacious but discreet. Anyone else would be sending an all-caps text around the island. Lisbeth and JJ reuniting at Props Bar. Lisbeth isn't sure what to say to the person she knows better than anyone on Earth.
Should she ask him about Christina? No. Should she launch into the story about the imposter Shelley Carpenter? No, he won't get it. He seems nervous. His hand shakes as he holds up the dinner menu. To put him at ease, she can't believe she's falling into the same old habit of worrying about his comfort. She asks about the restaurant.
Worst summer ever, he says.
We said that every August.
I'm serious, Libby. Everything sucks. The place has no soul. My cooking is technically sound, and the staff know what they're doing, but there's no love, no magic.
Well, Lisbeth thinks.
My travel tattler reviews are atrocious. Everyone calls the dining disappointing. It's like we're being punished for being great in the past. Any idea how frustrating that is? People hear, oh, the deck is the best, and they come in with unreasonable expectations. We're human beings running a restaurant. Things happen.
They certainly do.
I need you to come back, Libby.
Lisbeth scream laughs and Lee glances over. Lisbeth flags her. We're ready to order. There's no conflict or confusion where the menu is concerned because Lisbeth and JJ always get the same thing. They start with one order of fried green tomatoes with pimento cheese and black pepper honey and one order of the bone marrow. Then Lisbeth gets the chicken fried trout and JJ the Korean short ribs with kimchi grits.
Would you like another drink? Lee asks Lisbeth.
I'm going to stick with one, Lisbeth says. I have an early day tomorrow. She has an early day every day now and can't afford to stumble out of here the way she used to. When Lee leaves, Lisbeth says, I'm not coming back, JJ. You blew it. He swivels toward her so that his knees are kissing her leg. He puts his hand on the back of her bar stool, leans in, and speaks very softly. Lisbeth can't make out everything he says, but she gets the gist of it. I was such an idiot, a fool, a creep. I hate myself for what I did. I would do anything to go back to how it was. I was so unhappy with Christina. She's shallow and mean-spirited and insecure and so jealous of you. She almost ruined the restaurant. The staff hated her. She let some underage kids in on a Sunday and sold them the wine glasses, even though a blind man could have seen their IDs were fake. I would do anything to get you back. If you don't come back, I'm not sure what I'll do.
You'll do what we all do, JJ, she says. You'll keep on keeping on.
I'll sell the restaurant to Goose, he says. Walk away.
You would never.
Watch me.
It sounds like you're trying to threaten me, Lisbeth says. But I don't care if you sell the deck.
Why would I care? It's yours.
So you're telling me you don't care about the deck?
Lisbeth reaches for what's left of her celery man and finishes it.
I cared so much. That restaurant was our home. The staff was our family. But I wasn't the one who torched it, JJ. This is your arson, not mine.
Lee arrives with their appetizers.
Here we go, guys. One fried green tomatoes, one marrow. Anything else I can bring you?
Earplugs, Lisbeth thinks. A Valium. A graceful exit. She puts a tomato on a side plate for JJ, just like she always has. He spreads the luscious marrow on a thick golden slice of grilled bread for her.
Bon appetit,
they say together. Lisbeth can't get the first bite of tomato to her mouth fast enough. This is Nantucket in a nutshell. She's in emotional hell, but at least the surroundings are charming, the service impeccable, and the food maddeningly delicious. Between the appetizer and the entree, Lisbeth goes to the bathroom, where the walls are papered with pages from a vintage copy of June Platt's Party Cookbook, which provides menus for each day of the calendar year. March 24th, pea soup, dressed crab, bishop's pudding. The wallpaper improves Lisbeth's mood. Imagine every day a party. And when she gets back to the table, she decides to tell JJ the Heidi Bick Lyric Layton drama. He becomes engrossed in the story. Holy shit, he can't believe it. No, he hasn't heard about any of this, though, come to think of it, he hasn't seen the Bicks all summer. And he's seen the Laytons only once.
Yes, that was the night I was there, Lisbeth says. I saw Lyric at table 3. She was crying.
JJ clears his throat. Speaking of that night, what's up with you and Mario?
Lisbeth would love to say that things with her and Mario are hot and steamy, but she just shrugs.
I ended it.
JJ fiddles with the strap of Lisbeth's sundress, and she falls prey to memories of JJ zipping her dresses, clasping the hooks and eyes, fastening her necklaces. He could look at any outfit and tell her where they went the last time she wore it, what they ate, what they talked about, who they saw. His memory is his superpower, and it always made Lisbeth feel like he was paying attention. He had loved her, that was the thing. She knew he loved her. So how the hell did Christina get to him?
What happened? JJ says.
I wasn't ready.
She waves at Lee and points to her glass. She's like a woman in the throes of childbirth. I will take the epidural after all. But this thought leads her exactly where she doesn't want to go. Her brief pregnancy, the unprecedented joy, the intimacy she felt with JJ when the three of them were nestled in bed. She acknowledges that she wasn't the same after she miscarried. She stopped having sex with JJ. She kept him at arm's length, pushed him away. She'd felt so confused. She was mourning something she hadn't realized she'd even wanted. The drink arrives, delivering icy numbness. After a sip, she says, I couldn't let myself trust anyone again. JJ takes her face in his large, warm hands, pulls her in close like he's going to kiss her, and starts talking, his voice nearly a chant, the words coming out in an almost unintelligible rush. I made a huge mistake. I messed up. It won't happen again. I swear to God, Libby. I love you and only you, and I always have and I always will. We both love a good comeback story, right? And I want it to be the best comeback of all. I will do anything on earth if you just please. Please marry me. Be my wife. We will try again for children, or we will adopt, or we'll do both. Life is a crazy adventure. It's a road trip. I don't want any other woman in the passenger seat or in my bed but you, Lisbeth Keaton. Please, please listen to me. I love you. The words road trip remind Lisbeth of how, when they were driving to upstate New York to see JJ's parents or across the country to Minnetonka to see hers, and JJ was at the wheel, he would turn the radio down so Lisbeth could sleep. She, meanwhile, always kept the radio blaring while she was driving. She hears the words, in my bed, and thinks about how JJ liked to leave a bed unmade, the pillows askew, the comforter spiraled into a double helix. But Lisbeth couldn't stand it, and so, for 15 years, JJ made the bed properly, covers drawn tight, pillows stacked. He loved her. Where is she ever going to find someone who loves her like that again? She draws the breath of surrender, ready to say, okay, fine, I give up, you win, I'll come back. But then, over JJ's shoulder, she sees the front door to the restaurant open and a woman walk in. Lisbeth blinks. It's Yolanda. Lisbeth won't be able to handle it if Mario follows Yolanda in. But the person who comes in behind Yolanda is another woman. It's Beatrice. Huh, Lisbeth thinks. They're at the lectern, talking with Orla, the proprietor of proprietors. They're all laughing. Beatrice puts an arm around Yolanda and kisses her cheek. Orla plucks two menus off the lectern and leads Yolanda and Beatrice upstairs to the second floor dining room. And as they ascend the stairs, Yolanda and Beatrice are holding hands. Holding hands? And then it clicks. You know why Yolanda is always in the kitchen, right? Zeke said. And why she was always with the Blue Bar staff on Tuesdays, and why she asked for Tuesdays off in the first place, and why Mario was so openly affectionate with Yolanda. It occurs to Lisbeth that maybe the thing Yolanda needed Mario's help with was the surprise the kitchen staff arranged for Beatrice's birthday. They all chipped in and flew Beatrice's mother from Mexico City to Nantucket. Are you okay? JJ asks, following Lisbeth's gaze over his shoulder. The reason Yolanda is always hanging out in the kitchen isn't Mario. It's Beatrice. Take my trout home, she says. I have to go. She hurries down the brick sidewalks of India to Water Street, moving as fast as she can in her wedges, thinking, it's Tuesday, his day off. He'll be out somewhere or entertaining another woman. He's Mario freaking Subiaco, for God's sake. But Lisbeth keeps going. She takes a left down the white shell path behind Old North Wharf and sees Mario's silver truck. He's home. This nearly propels Lisbeth back to proprietors, back to JJ and safety. It's ludicrous that she considers JJ safe after what he did to her. Familiar might be a better word. But every inspirational meme that Lisbeth has stuffed inside her hollow places, like a girl desperately patting her bra, tells her to move forward. Not on fighting the old, but on building the new. She strides out the long dock without wobbling or faltering, and when she reaches the door, she takes a breath and acknowledges that this could be a very awkward moment. But she knocks anyway. There are footsteps, then a pause, and then Mario opens the door. He's wearing gym shorts, a gray t-shirt, his white socks cap on backward. He's so handsome that Lisbeth steadies herself against the shingled wall of the cottage. She peers over his shoulder. There's a beer on the table, an open pizza box, one plate. Does he seem surprised to see her? Not really. He leans into the doorframe and gives her his slow half-smile. Hey, heartbreaker, he says. Hey, she whispers. Chapter 21. The Cobblestone Telegraph. When deep August arrives, a certain melancholy sets in, the kind people get on a Sunday afternoon. The summer, which seemed so endless back in June, will be over in a few short weeks. Some of us are already saying goodbye. One of our local authors cries into the front of her son's t-shirt as she hugs him at the ferry. He's headed back to the University of South Carolina, a school that has been popular with kids from Nantucket High School ever since Link Dooley went there. Later that night, the local author is seen at the Blue Bar with her entourage drinking a heartbreaker. Why do schools go back so early now? She asks. When we were kids, the first day of school was the Tuesday after Labor Day. Yes, certain among us remember our parents rushing us into Murray's Toggery on the Saturday of Labor Day weekend so that we could get new school shoes. Then it was off to Joe the barber or Claire at the beauty salon who would give us fresh haircuts and sweep our sun-bleached locks up off the floor. Blonde Sharon holds dear the memory of her parents, who always booked the last ferry off the island on Labor Day itself. Then Sharon's father would drive through the dark hours back to Connecticut. Sharon and her sister Heather would start school in the morning, often with sand still trapped in the whorls of their ears. We were tired, but we never complained, Sharon says, because we wanted to squeeze every second out of the summer. Nearly all Nantucketers agree with this sentiment, and we bristle when people try to jump the season. Jill Tannenbaum sees an Instagram post of a pumpkin spice latte in her feed on August 18th, and she immediately unfollows. A rumor goes around that Lisbeth Keaton and JJ O'Malley were seen eating together at the bar at Proprietors. They were huddled close, according to sources, and appeared to be having a very intense conversation. Were they reuniting? Some of us hoped yes. Lisbeth was needed back at the deck pronto. The quality of the experience had slipped significantly. But a day or two later, these hopes were dashed when we heard that Lisbeth and Mario Subiaco were dating again. Tracy Toland and Carl Grabowski, two of our favorite summer visitors, and newlyweds to boot, were eating dinner on the deck at the Strait Wharf and, in the moonlight, they caught sight of Lisbeth and Mario kissing on the front porch of the little cottage that sat by itself out in the harbor. The reuniting of Lisbeth and Chef Subiaco is confirmed on the third Saturday of August when they attend our favorite charity benefit of the season together, the Summer Groove, which raises money for the Nantucket Boys and Girls Club. Lisbeth is wearing a lilac silk dress, and her blonde hair is styled in a braid crown.
Mario wears a navy blazer and a matching lilac tie. They hold hands all night. They drift over to the Raw Bar, where Mario doctors cherrystone clams with lemon and cocktail sauce and oysters with mignonette before handing them to Lisbeth. They accept hors d'oeuvres from silver trays, even though the offerings at this party aren't quite as ambrosial as what we've been eating all summer at the Blue Bar. The bakery box has spoiled us. It turns out that Lisbeth and Chef Subiaco have donated one of the auction items for the event, a three-night stay at the Hotel Nantucket for the following summer, plus a chef's tasting for two with cocktails at the Blue Bar. There are numerous competing bidders, all of them seemingly relentless, and the item goes for $35,000. People in the tent go crazy. It is, however, a bit awkward when the next auction item is announced, dinner for 10 at the Deck, including signature stemless wine glasses for the rosé fountain. In years past, this item garnered the highest bid, but tonight only one hand is raised. It belongs to Janice, the dental hygienist whose brother, Goose, is the Deck sommelier. Janice accidentally bids against herself. She's had a lot of wine, but even so, she wins the package for $2,500, which is less than the package is actually worth. Discreetly, we look around the tent, searching for JJ, and are relieved to discover he's not in attendance. The Summer Groove is not only the best charity event of the summer, it's also the final one. When we wake up the next morning, our spirits sag. All we have to look forward to now are the lasts. The last great beach days, the last lobster omelet and Whispering Angel lunch at the galley, the last stroll over the Sundial Bridge in Sconset, the last chance to surfcast in Maya Comet, the last long afternoon drinking Grippa at Cisco Brewers, the last of the zucchini and corn at Bartlett's Farm. Tomatoes will go strong until September and, eek, are those pumpkins we see? We can squeeze in one more boat ride up the harbor to watch the kiteboarders, check out one more juicy summer novel from the Athenaeum, and eat one more fish sandwich at the Oyster Catcher while the sun sets over the water and guitarist Sean Lee sings that it's hard to get by just upon a smile. But then Romeo at the Steamship Authority reports that some really rich dude is sending a Bentley over on the ferry with a chauffeur. And not only that, but this same dude is flying in from London on his G5.
He'll be here Wednesday, Romeo says.
Who could it be, we wonder. And then we realize, it's Xavier Darling. Chapter 22 Cedar and Salt. August 22nd, 2022. From Xavier Darling, xd at darlingent.com.uk. To employees of the Hotel Nantucket. Greetings all, good morning. Although I am busy preparing for my trip across the pond, I have not forgotten about this week's bonus. I'm pleased to announce Edith Robbins as our winner. One heartfelt letter described the myriad ways that Edith went above and beyond during a family's extended stay. Wonderful job, Edith. I will arrive Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Please prepare the footmen and the trumpeters. Joking, of course. XD. Lisbeth has known for months that Xavier would be arriving on August 24th, but the date seemed impossibly far in the future. And then, as it drew closer, Lisbeth was consumed with other things. However, time did what it always does. It passed. Xavier arrives tomorrow. Lisbeth waits until there's a break between fitness classes, then enters the yoga studio, which is pleasantly dark. She sets one of the thick mats in the middle of the room and considers turning on some gamelan music, but decides that the sound of gurgling water over river stones in the fountain is pleasing enough. She assumes a savasana pose and tries not to think. Half an hour later, just as her eyes naturally flutter open, this room must have supernatural powers because she actually slept, there's a light tap on the door. The door cracks open. Heartbreaker? It's Mario. Lisbeth loves the sound of his voice.
She lies back down.
Hey.
She nearly tells him to lock the door behind him so they can christen the yoga studio.
But really, what is she thinking?
Mario stands over her, holding her espresso.
Edie told me you were down here and I almost didn't believe her. What's going on?
I needed to rest.
She stands up and kisses him, and I did.
Well, he says, handing her the coffee, that makes one of us.
Are you nervous about Xavier?
He's my boss too, Mario says. You noticed I tossed and turned last night?
You did?
Since they've been back together, Mario has spent every night at Lisbeth's cottage. Lisbeth climbs into bed at a reasonable hour, wakes up when Mario comes in, then dozes right back off.
What are you nervous about?
I'm not sure.
The bar is amazing, Mario, Lisbeth says. It's packed every night, and it has an absurdly high rating on every restaurant review app. It's positioned to become every bit as iconic as the Blue Bistro, if not more so.
Mario smiles, but she can tell he's not feeling it.
I'm serious, she says.
I know, Mario says. But men like Xavier.
I'm the one who should be nervous, Lisbeth says. I have a whole hotel to present. 12 suites, 36 rooms, the lobby, the pools, the gym and sauna, this studio. But I'm confident in what we built.
She wraps her arms around Mario's neck and presses the length of her body against him.
I know you're anxious because you've lost a restaurant on this island before, but Xavier is going to love us. We have absolutely nothing to worry about.
That evening, at change of shift, Lisbeth calls a meeting in the break room. She asks Love to watch the desk so that Richie can come to the meeting along with Edie, Alessandra, Adam, Raul, Zeke, Magda, and Yolanda. Lisbeth thinks about the staff meeting she called back on opening day, when the hotel was like a fawn wobbling on new legs. She had barely known these people, and they'd barely known one another. Richie has shed 30 pounds, gotten a tan, and is smiling far more genuinely than the night Lisbeth interviewed him. He's in love with Kimber Marsh, their long-term guest. It's the stuff rom-coms are made of. Lisbeth will not mention this romance to Xavier, however, in case he disapproves. Edie has been consistently thoughtful and kind, the perfect foil for Alessandra, with her fierce beauty and blinding confidence. But even Alessandra has softened a bit lately, so much so that Lisbeth noticed Edie and Alessandra laughing together. Lisbeth did a double take. Was it genuine? Yes, it seemed so. Zeke has grown into the bellman job beautifully. If his mother could see him now, she would be so proud. Yolanda is as serene as a hidden pond in an enchanted wood, and Lisbeth is so glad she didn't tell Mario about her suspicions, because once that genie was out of the bottle, it could never have been put back. Lisbeth would feel awkward, and so would Yolanda and Mario and Beatrice. Magda sits with perfect posture on the edge of the sofa, legs crossed at the ankles. She remains unreadable, a sphinx. Has she ever let her guard down, shared a candid moment or personal revelation? She has not. She is the ultimate professional. Lisbeth hasn't worried for one second about housekeeping. There hasn't been a single complaint about the cleanliness of the rooms. There were the two missing items, but Magda handled these incidents herself with the guests and her staff. Housekeeping is the bedrock of any hotel. If the hotel isn't clean, forget it. Which makes Magda the most important person on the staff, maybe more important than Lisbeth herself. Lisbeth remembers thinking that she didn't want to know her staff's secrets, but now that summer is nearly over, she decides that she would very much like to know Magda's secrets. Mr. Darling is arriving tomorrow, Lisbeth says. I want you all to do your jobs precisely the way you've been doing them. Mr. Darling will introduce himself to all of you over the course of his stay. We want to make sure he's comfortable and that his needs are met just like any other guest. Does anyone have any questions?
How long will he be here? Adam asks.
4 nights, Lisbeth says. He's scheduled to leave on Sunday. Alessandra raises her hand. Does Mr. Darling have dinner reservations? If he wants to go to Crewe or Nautilus,
then he needed to make them 30 days ago, Edie says.
But Alessandra has an inn at Nautilus, and I've developed a nice rapport with the reservations people at Crewe. So just let us know.
Excellent question, Lisbeth says. Xavier hasn't said a word about what he plans to do during his visit. It's his first time to Nantucket. He should read the Blue Book, or Lisbeth can pull together some itineraries for him. She wonders if the chauffeur, who is staying at the beach club because their own hotel is full, knows how to drive a jeep on the beach. I'll find out what Mr. Darling's plans are once I speak to him in person. If that's all the questions, then I'll end the meeting. Please, everyone, go home and get a good night's sleep. I'll see you bright and early tomorrow.
Xavier is coming, Grace thinks. Xavier is coming. She feels a surge in her energy levels. She wants to haunt the hotel. Mary Perkowski in room 205 came all the way from Broadview Heights, Ohio, in hopes of some spooky business. But Grace needs to reserve her energy so she can enjoy tomorrow's fanfare. Grace isn't the only one who's all dialed up for Xavier's arrival. Zeke arrives at the hotel with a new haircut. Alessandra swaps out her clear eye crystals for ones that are sapphire blue. Edie's attention to guest services becomes so intense, like sunlight through a magnifying glass, that Lisbeth gently reminds her that some people prefer to figure things out on their own. Richie surprises Kimber while she's on her laptop and sees that she's ordering school supplies from Staples to be delivered to her apartment in New York City.
Do you have to think about back to school already?
Kimber snaps her laptop shut. It can't be avoided. The teachers at PS6 like the children to be prepared on day one, pencils sharpened. And have you met my daughter, Wanda? She was bugging me to order this stuff weeks ago. Richie flops in the window seat and gazes out at Easton Street as a couple on a bicycle built for two pedal by.
I have to mentally prepare myself. All of this is coming to an end. I'll stay at the hotel until Columbus Day. I promised Lisbeth that much. But it won't be the same without you and the children here. We only have a few days left.
Kimber settles between Richie's legs and leans her head back against his chest. Doug the dog lies on the floor at their feet. He lifts his head when Grace hovers over him and starts to whine. He's still not used to her. Why don't you come to New York after Columbus Day? Kimber says. Live with us.
I couldn't do that.
Why not? There are plenty of jobs in the city. My divorce will be final, or nearly.
You wanted a summer romance, Richie says.
Well, maybe now I want a romance, Kimber says. She wraps Richie's arms around her. I don't want this to end. Grace sighs, so sweet. She would like to think of Kimber and Richie ending up together when they leave here. She wants to believe that the hotel is more than just cedar and salt. It's a place that can create at least one happily ever after. On the morning of the 24th, Chad gets to work early at Ms. English's request. He figures this is because of Mr. Darling's arrival. The hotel has